Hey everyone, are you an entrepreneur or a small business owner with store locations? It's time for you to jam with Gary. Check out the blog post below for more details on this ridiculous business development opportunity with VFriends, and be sure to fill out the form included in that blog post. It's a really fun opportunity for you brick and mortar small business people out there, so click that link and get to work.
This is the Gary V Audio Experience.
Let's talk about innovation.
Okay. Right?
We've seen a fair amount of innovation dominate the headlines in the past few years. Crypto, NFTs, metaverse, AI, GC now. Many have failed, while a select few have succeeded. So what's your take on tech innovation, and what separates the real innovations from the fad?
You know, it's a good call out. There's clearly, however one defines Web3, it definitely feels like it's here, it's brewing. You know, I use the term to be a catch-all, including things like AR, definitely AI. And again, kind of like Web 1 and Web 2, like the internet used to be called the World Wide Web. And, you know, social media used to be called Web 2.0. When I used to talk about Facebook and Twitter, we would say these Web 2.0 companies, not social media companies. So I'm not sure what the world decides to call AI, Web3, you know, or something else, whether it calls decentralized servers and blockchains Web3 or something else. But I think everyone here, especially, you know, it's a young crowd in here, but anyone who's a historian of the last 35, 40 years of innovation, I think we're clearly, to your point of the question, in this new frontier where the social media era of the last decade and the iPhone and things of that nature has had its run, and you can kind of sense like, uh-oh, like something's happening here and it's gonna be a thing. I think the thing that separates it is a lot of what I talked about a year ago, being at the forefront of a lot of the NFT talk 18, 15, 16 months ago. I just started making unbelievable amount of content that 99% of these projects were gonna go to zero. And a lot of my friends were mad about that, people in the space. And the reason I made those videos at scale is the answer to your question. The thing that separates the real things from the fake things when there's a sea change in technology is there's a very tiny percentage of people that are patient and want to build something meaningful and have the patience to let the rest of the world catch up. But you have to be patient for a decade for it to achieve the hyperbole of the promise when it's emerging. And then there's 99% of people who are greedy and want to make as much money as humanly possible and could give a shit about building something meaningful. They see a moment, they get caught up in the gold rush. And then, by the way, within that 99%, 90% of them don't even realize they're doing it. It's not that they have bad intent, they just get way ahead of it. People forget that Web 1.0 in the late 90s, You had internet companies that had zero revenue, be worth billions of dollars in stock value on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ in 1998, in 1999. People get ahead of themselves. The metaverse conversation 18 months ago, the reason I did nothing on that was nobody was doing it. You know, to me, QR codes are interesting because people are doing it. But even AR, which is pretty far along, and there's a lot of people doing it, it's still small out of 8 billion people. And so I'm excited about all this stuff, but it's gonna take some time. AI is fascinating because it's something we've been talking about in more nerd talk than marketing and business talk for 6, 7, 8 years. I mean, I am an early stage investor. I was looking at startups that claimed to be doing AI for the last 7, 8 years, but a lot of times they were just APIs being clumped together, and it wasn't AI. Maybe it was a little bit of machine learning. Now we're starting to see it, and it's got everybody kind of caught up and excited and concerned. But that, even that, with the amount of users it has, will take time to hit the masses. But to answer your question, I think it's a very simplistic truth of human beings. Most lack patience to build something meaningful, and most want to move quickly. Bringing it back to Web 2 or your platform, the amount of people who post four times on TikTok and are stunned that they haven't gone viral yet is laughable. You know, people struggle with putting in the work for a long period of time to achieve something meaningful. And I think that happens a lot when there's innovation. Because when there's innovation that's confusing, you can trick people. And so that's, unfortunately, consciously or subconsciously, people take advantage of that, and that's why there's crashes. As a matter of fact, those are the most interesting times to start building. The most interesting time to start building in NFT blockchain world is now that it's in a down market of a correction of hyperbole of last year, but there's a lot more awareness and usage and a lot of learnings that have been done. Now is the time over the next 3 to 5 years to build something significant to have the opportunity unfold in, you know, 7, 8, 9 years.
Look, patience, I think, is not a natural human trait. I guess that's why we see these ups and downs. But talking about patience and people trying to go viral with four pieces of content, and therefore content at scale starts becoming something to solve for. What's the role potentially of AI in solving for content at scale or creativity at scale?
Well, it's clearly coming. I think, you know, what's gonna be interesting is once everyone's doing it, it becomes a commodity. And so what's then gonna break through? Over the next 5 years, you'll have people that move faster on using AI for content creation, and they'll get a land grab. But somewhere in the next decade or two, it'll be no different than using a search engine. I built my dad's wine business in the late 90s because I realized that Google search ads were good, and I spent all the money on it, and I was acquiring customers for 12 cents customer acquisition costs. That didn't last forever. Eventually people figured it out. I also built it on the back of email marketing. In 1998, sending an email to sell somebody something was like going to the moon. We had 95% open rates on email. 95% open rates on email. It was absurd. I was running banner ads on winespectator.com, getting 14% click-through. 14% click-through on banner ads, because on a website, a banner ad seemed cool in 1997, in 1999. So there'll be a window right now where there'll be leaders with who will create, and they'll create more content, more specific. The AI will do a better job than even people that have spent 20 years trying to be good at it. And that's fine, and that will be normalized. The problem is, or the opportunity is, what will be the next step? More importantly, to me, these AI products that are out there right now, forget about we have to figure out copyright and trademark. I mean, we can't even begin to use the creative products at our agency because we don't know the sources of the creative. And we have contracts with our clients that put us in a vulnerable spot. But entrepreneurs and small businesses, they'll do it all day long. The question becomes, the critical thinking of the input becomes a really interesting game. You know, it's really funny for me to watch all these schools and universities ban all these products. They'd rather have kids memorize information that's a commodity than start teaching people critical thinking of inputting into the AI products, which is actually the punchline. I had a real epiphany 2 years ago when I started seeing this really brewing, and then really, obviously, like everyone else, a year ago when it popped off. I was like, wait a minute, this is what I've been waiting for my whole life. I've never been good at the commodity. I can't put 7 sentences together that are proper grammar, but I can come up with the ideas that actually matter. And so I'm actually very excited. I've heard a lot of people talk about this is bad for the creative industry. I'm like, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to the creative industry. It's just gonna be the greatest thing that happens to the creative people. The commodity of creativity, executing it, that's gonna be commoditized. But that's what's always happened. That's what the tractor did to farming, right? You know, I see a lot of people taking a very extreme point of view on this, like, this is terrible, I'm not even gonna use it. I'm like, well, you use your iPhone. Your iPhone put people out of business. You don't feel bad for the people that used to work at the retail store, standing on the retail floor helping you buy something. You buy and get 1 mile delivery. Like, innovation's always gonna do this. So I think the interesting thing is twofold. One, this is about to expose the most creative critical thinkers, and I think she and he is gonna have a very good, you know, decade, two, three, four. And two, you know, I think it's still gonna come down to the idea. You know, you're still gonna have to input, like, write me a sentence in the voice of Porky Pig that talks about, like, you're still gonna have to come up with that. And so I think we're gonna start seeing people realize no different than the thing I talked about 15 years ago, which was personal brand was gonna matter because reputation at scale matters. And all that social media has done is exposed and framed up and mapped what has always been important, which is your reputation matters. And if you can scale it, it matters even more. I think that ideas and creativity have always mattered. I think the process of getting to ideas, both in Madison Avenue in advertising and in the creative field, has actually become clunky, inefficient, and rewards a lot of people that don't bring any value to it. I think AI is going to have a very big impact on separating the people that have great ideas versus the ones that don't, and I think it's gonna be interesting to watch.
We've got a whole audience of people who obviously think of inspire creativity and bring joy as their mission in life, or at least in the workplace. So, you know, taking a tangent from there, let's jump into digital entertainment, right? Because that's probably the most practical exemplification of creativity. People spend quite a bit of time on entertainment on platforms like TikTok. But what strikes me as counterintuitive is how e-commerce and online shopping is still pretty transactional and functional as an experience instead of an entertaining one. So how do you see shoppertainment unfolding?
Well, I think if I'm understanding your question in the way you're framing it, what your platform's evolving into and definitely doing in different parts of the world, because obviously the product plays differently in different parts of the world, is you're eliminating friction from what I think about shoppertainment. Shoppertainment has been going on forever. I started a wine show on YouTube on February 21st, 2006.
Hello everyone and welcome to the first episode of Wine Library TV.
That is 17 years ago. It was called Shoppertainment. I took a camera, drank four bottles of wine in front of this new platform called YouTube that I thought was going to be big. And the entire purpose of it was, I want the wines that I think are good to sell at my dad's liquor store. And the way I did that, and talk about friction. Hey kids, back then, you took your video on YouTube and you took the embed code and you put it on your website. So people would go to winelibrarytv.com for an embedded YouTube video, and I had a WordPress plugin for comments. And that's how I built community. Tons of friction. But what I was able to do was, in the WordPress platform, I was able to link the products that were in the video to the website. And so you'd have to go to this website, so you didn't even find it in YouTube. You'd have to watch it. You'd have to then click on the desktop WordPress, the link to the website. Then it would take you to the product page and you'd have to go and shop. A lot of friction. Here we are 17 years later. You can be in a platform like a TikTok. If the quality of the content is strong, you can get more awareness from one post than I was able to build in 6 years of real good work and hard work. And as you continue to develop the product, the frictionless nature of being able to buy the product that is in that video is gonna be one click, if that, right? So I think it's always been going on. You know, people have been buying clothes from a picture on Instagram for a long time. They see it, even if it wasn't tagged in the photo, they'd figure it out, they'd go to Google, they'd find it. This is why Google continues to get unlimited credit for last touch attribution for things that they haven't created. The intent was created on Instagram. Google gets the credit because it's a toll booth of transactions, at least in this generation, and so that's interesting. So what do I think? I think this has been going on. People looked at Vogue magazine in 1984 and saw an outfit that they were interested in and then drove to Saks Fifth Avenue and bought it. Right? Shoppertainment. They would watch the Oscars and be inspired by a dress and buy the less expensive version of it at Neiman Marcus, 1979. So this has been going on. All the technology is doing now is creating less and less and less friction to do the thing that's always been going on.
Love it, thanks Gary. Very spot on, I think, in terms of the conversations we have with our partners too. One of the challenges we do face with partners, clients, agencies, publishers, is they understand why maybe they need to lean into these types of innovations. They get the what they need to do, it's on the how that they struggle. And it's the, you know, how can we sprinkle some of the Gary Vee mindset of you gotta try things and be patient with clients and partners?
I think it's very hard for platforms because the agencies have too much power. Right, at the end of the day, the brands you're referring to have agencies of record, and those agencies of record are not incentivized to move their dollars to your platform because your platform actually requires work. It's a lot more fun to buy television and programmatic banners where they make much more margin doing something that means nothing to nobody. So to answer that question, it just goes back to patience. These holding company agencies that are holding on for dear life continue to lose market share and confidence because the world's moving, not because I'm posting something on LinkedIn. I'm a speckle. But we are the preview. Every agency in the world will look a lot more like VaynerMedia. And so that's just the truth. Unfortunately, the intermediary between you and the client is not incentivized to use your product. Period, end of story. They just don't make as much margin. They also don't know how. I think the biggest thing that everyone here knows, if they deal with creative agencies, the classic creative agencies, which are 99% of the creative AORs, they don't know how to make social media content. They know how to make TV commercials. They're in the business of spending 9 months debating one idea and making a piece of shit video that nobody watches, that costs a fortune. That's their business. And, you know, I think we're getting closer. This is something I've been beating the drum of for 13 years. I think everyone here, the giggles and the head nods of when I say that now are very different than they were 15 years ago. Nobody giggled, nobody laughed. They thought I was audacious, inappropriate, didn't know what I was talking about. For me, it's not that I know what I'm talking about or what I don't know if I'm talking about it. It's that I don't understand how people don't follow human attention. Human attention is the asset. To me, you know, to hit something very much at home for this group, people ask me all the time, what if something gets banned? What if something changes? Vine used to be big, then it got bought. I'm always like, then the attention's gonna go somewhere. If all of social media disappears off the face of the earth tomorrow, that's an opportunity for me because 8 billion people are still gonna put their attention somewhere, whether that's connected TV, whether that's VR, you know, AV, AR, you know, VR, like it's, the attention's gonna go. I'll run print ads if the whole world's reading magazines. So I think this emotion, the emotion of holding up a distribution platform is a humongous vulnerability. I mean, I'm just prepared on an everyday basis to wake up and adjust to where humans have given their attention. And then I think it's very important, this is why I love this platform and always have been so pro this platform. I also think it's a good idea to bring value to people. You know, I think what's really evolved in the death of television ads is that not only have we, over the last two decades, moved our attention to other places with the growth and expansion of the internet, but the value proposition of a commercial on television is zero. You know, if the ads happen to be decent, somewhat interesting, somewhat intriguing, it could still be a much more viable medium than it is today. It's why the Super Bowl in America continues to work. But, you know, they're just not. And by the way, most TikToks are not valuable either. It's just there's so many of them on a daily basis that even if 1% is good, that's a lot of good. whereas television commercials are low. There's not so many of them, and none of them are good.
We always like to remind, with all the humility in the world, our partners that people are not against ads, they're against bad ads, right? And to your point, the reason why people tune into the Super Bowl is because that's one of the few moments where there's decent ads and good ads. And fully on board.
And I apologize. I would argue a lot of the ads are not good, but it's a cultural phenomenon to tune in. A bunch of texts that, you know, this morning I'm reading the team talking globally on WhatsApp, and they're like, the Oscars were up 18% in viewership, and my contribution was, but nobody watched the ads. The Oscars might be up 18% because we're getting out of into a post-COVID world. And I also think there's a huge opportunity for someone to innovate. The world is so fragmented now. Think about how your product works. You know, your product is based on the interest graph, not the social graph. This is why I was such a big advocate of Tumblr and an early investor in 2008 of Tumblr. It was built on the interest graph, not the social graph. But what happens when you build on the interest graph is we get into a fragmented world. So I actually think the Oscars were up 18% in America because humans are subconsciously yearning for joint experience. The World Cup is fun because we're all watching the same thing. We're getting pushed, not just by your platform, the world is going in one direction. We will be fragmented, which means there's an opportunity for 10 or 20 things to bring us all together. There's incredible opportunity for that. But I think it's not that there's good ads. Really, I think more than half of them are a complete waste of $20 million. I think it's just a cultural phenomenon for us to all be joined in. And so I'm excited about that. I'm excited about the evolution of us finding new things for all of us to watch together, maybe even globally, now that we're all connected.
We're at the beginning of that journey. I can't claim that we've fully fulfilled that aspiration. But
it's also very hard. Just on the record, like when I hear that, I literally was just laughing. I didn't do it outwardly because that would have been disrespectful. But when you said that, I was laughing for one very specific reason. You're in market share grab mode right now. The company's growing right now. It's like hard to both be fully foot on the pedal, exploding, and finding, you know, the balance of that. It's hard. It's like there's, you know, everyone's trying to find this balance, but balance comes in the macro, not in the micro. You get balance in a 10-year window, not in like today. Like it's hard to find that because you're on the offense. Like it's just hard. It's hard when you're like in the zone of like gaining muscle and losing weight to also eat cake every day.
Well, hunger and hustle are part of the culture, so hopefully we will be comfortable and complacent.
But to the point, on the counterpoint is, I do think you can be both hungry and hustle and be happy and content, but I don't think that comes from optics. I think it comes from how you treat each other. I don't think that comes from like, let's put a foosball table in the middle of the office, or let's create coffee talks with people when they come in. I think it only manifests in truth, not tactics. I think the way you'll get to that joy is if everyone's nice to each other, and if you have the ability and the conviction to fire the three people in here that are assholes. People are very confused. Joy doesn't come from 4-hour work weeks. Joy doesn't come from free donuts. Joy comes from firing dickheads.
And that's gonna be my new status.
And it's very hard because a lot of times people that are bringing the negativity to the organization are also top performers. Top performers come from two places. They're either driven by confidence or they're driven by insecurity. Most are driven by insecurity. Insecurity then starts to manifest in their day-to-day in suppressing others. This is where the world's got this very, you know, I think it's very possible to have a work environment where people are going very hard but are very happy, but I only think it comes from the way we treat each other internally. And so that's the thing to think about.
Love it. Thank you. I've asked you a lot of questions. I'd love for the audience to ask their questions. And we've got one in the back over there, Omar.
My question is regarding the culture aspect of things. And your point came in at a time when we've actually just finished our performance review cycle. In your opinion, and especially considering the size of the organization and the growing size, what's the best way to figure out these inefficiencies when it comes to people?
For us, much smaller organization, we only have, 1,500 to 2,000 employees, it's making our chief heart officer have more say than our chief financial officer. I mean, look, this is what it comes down to, and this is what's so challenging. The only way to have a great culture, like a great one, like one that is, like the one that people dream of, is to value it more than the P&L. The amount of companies that go there are almost none. Not because they're bad people, but because most people are held accountable to the P&L more than the subjective nature of the culture. You just said we did reviews. My brain, again, said, ugh. And I'll tell you why. When my company does reviews, it's the worst time of year for me because it's completely subjective, yet we act as it's not. A human is making the call. This is where I need the robots to come in and take us out. Because what happens is there's a lot of subconscious work going on by managers on employees that is not seen. For example, many managers will create, I'm gonna give you some candor, but they're using it to actually make the employees underneath them to manipulate the reality of the situation, because that manager subconsciously, not consciously, is aware that the person they're managing is stronger than them. But they have to subconsciously protect themselves and their family and their wants and needs. I mean, review time is so challenging, but it's the only way to create a crazy culture is to have it have equal, if not more say, than the financial part of the organization. Sales teams here in companies that look like this are always a hornet's nest for bad behavior because it's completely predicated on revenue. It's just very like black and white. Like, I'm successful if I hit my quota, I'm not if I don't. It leads to less teamwork, leads to a lot of things. Bonuses are a fucking disaster. I didn't do it for a decade. I got convinced by my leadership to do it. I fucking hate it. I'm gonna kill it. It's the fucking worst. Everything sucks. Everything sucks in corporate environments besides humans fighting for kindness. I believe that to be true. Now, I also think you need to be building a real thing. I'm saying all this jargon. I just want to remind everybody, 8 minutes ago, I talked about working 9 to 9. Very politically not correct. It's just also true. Like, if you outwork someone, like, work ethic is part of the equation. And it just is. But I think kindness is the ingredient that matters in culture. And I do not think I don't believe that people fight for it. Like, my employees are fascinated. Somebody reached out to me the other day for a 10-minute meeting. She was like, I've been here for 4 years. I've seen you on 50 emails that are like, revenue's up 9%. We just sold this. Da-da-da-da. She's like, you never respond. She said, we let go of a toxic employee. They emailed you with a bunch of bullshit. And you had all of us within 9 minutes on a Zoom to talk it through. She's like, I'm glad I got to be in that meeting because I got to see how you handle bullshit from a toxic employee. You weren't pointing at us. We did a 360 and we moved on. She's like, but I just want to say thank you because all the real business emails, you just don't even engage with, but someone's feelings, we were in a fucking 4-9-1-1 meeting, right? And that's what I think is real. At the end of the day, it's either words or it's actions. And humans figure out very quickly when it's just words. And I have too much empathy. Unless you own the company with no board and no one holding you accountable, he's not able to have enough control to build culture. He's got 37 bosses above him. It's true. I tell people, and the reason I bring that up is to say, for me, it's easy. I'm the owner, nobody has say. This is why I stand up and say everything at this company, if this was my, everything at this company is my fault, because it's true. Very few things are his fault. Very few things are your fault. The only thing that's your fault when it comes to this is, are you nice to everyone? Or are you full of shit? Right? That's easy. What's really hard in corporations is when seemingly you have control, but you don't. Because then people cast judgment on you, but you don't have the leverage to do it. So I think that requires empathy. One of the reasons that our company has really worked is we've educated employees of like, you're mad at your manager, but do you know that their dad just died? Like, we are in a very weird time in the world where judgment of others has become cool. And it's hurting us. We need to, people love to say empathy, 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 but they don't deploy empathy to people above them. You understand? It's really, yeah, of course you have empathy for someone who's like got hurt and got ran over by a car. Cool. What about real empathy? 360, not selective empathy that fits your personal point of view of the moment. That's what we need to fight for.
Hey.
Hi.
I'm Sarah, by the way.
Nice to meet you.
You talk about, this is not a business related question. You talk about kindness a lot in your videos. Some people are afraid to be kind because they don't want to be mistaken for
weak.
Weak, or so people don't respect them and all of that.
Yes.
What about the other person? What about the kind person, but people mistake them for being weak? What advice do you have for those type of people?
I want to make sure I understand that last part because I was following. For the person that is kind and is being perceived as weak?
How can they tell someone without telling them that? Don't mistake my kindness for
sweetness. Execution. You're not gonna do it through words, right? Because you're gonna do it through execution. So for me, through my career, many times customers, rarely customers actually, it's not true, vendors, employees, a lot of people have mistakenly taken my kind interactions for weakness. The way they've been recalibrated is by action. You know, if you think I'm weak and you're gonna steal from me when I fire you and put you in jail, you realize I'm not weak. If you're a vendor who thinks I'm weak in negotiating and I, at the last minute, buy all the product from someone else instead of you, you very quickly realized you were mistaken. I think, now that doesn't mean, in those two examples I talked about extreme things. What's really amazing about the world is most people don't listen to the barking, they listen to the biting. And so, you know, I'm more fascinated not by your question, which is very easy to answer. People will realize that, whether this is for you or for someone else, they will realize that it, through action, who you are. I'm more fascinated by the person that thinks invoking fear into people or barking or seemingly not being kind is a good strategy when they're incapable to execute with action on the back end. Then you just become a barking dog that everybody realizes will never bite, and then you become a doormat and people walk all over you. And you've lost twice. So I think, you know, I think that journey of how do you act as a kind person? First, I'm not worried if people think I'm weak. First, it might be a journey for yourself to think about your own insecurity. Once you don't value people's opinions as your own validation versus whether pro or con, it gets very easy to navigate what I'm talking about. There are unlimited people who think I'm full of shit, who think I'm weak, who think I have no depth, and I'm empathetic to that. They watch one little clip of a stitch or duet on TikTok and they take what I said out of context and they've decided to make their judgment on me. That doesn't mean that's who I am. It means it's someone's perception. So I think that's, it's a two-parted question for you. One, do you actually worry about people thinking you're weak. Once you eliminate that, everything gets easy. And then two, if you're actually talking about the substance, that's never gonna be done by words, it's gonna be done by action.
Let's take two more questions. I think we've got one in the back over there.
Hi.
So I have two questions here. The first one is that would you hire the creative critical thinker in your organization? And two, where would you put them because they're not following the book and they critically think and criticize the things that have been done?
To me, that's the only people we hire. You know, for me, creatives and strategists should only be doing that. You know, like, to me, what is why I'm so excited about AI for the creative industry is it's gonna go into a direction of, instead of opinion and politicking in a room, an output of ideas, I think, and that's gonna be very good for the industry.
You said something that agencies in the future are gonna look a lot less like creative agencies now and a lot more like gaming. What will gaming media look like in 10 years?
We're gonna look the same as always. Right now, we are a creative agency, except we think that we need to create 40 to 70 to 100 pieces of creative a day across 7 to 10 different social media platforms. Let the qualitative and quantitative impact of that work give us more insights. We don't think it's test and learn. We don't think it's spray and pray. We think it's marketing for the sake of making better marketing. And as we extract those insights, both quant and qual, it leads us to making better work that we're willing to spend more money against to take a bet on because we've had consumer affirmation all the way to making our Super Bowl commercials based on the insights of a single piece of TikTok or Instagram or a tweet. That's very different than hiring an agency to come up with an idea in a boardroom, sell it to you, and then you get a third-party production company to make a 30-second video, and then you make some banner ads and some other bullshit and put it into the world. So I think that audacious, insecure creatives sitting in a room down versus creative at scale against 40 to 50 consumer segmentations to win on relevance up is gonna be a monumental shift in the way that creative work is done. And so that's where I think it's going.
I have a question.
I think Maha has a question.
I'd love you to tell everyone what PAC is.
Why Maha asked that is at Vayner, we have an acronym PAC, platforms and culture. So basically our religion, no different than the question that I just had about do you hire for that? It's the only thing we hire for. Everybody in our company is obsessed with PAC, platforms and culture. What does that mean? It means that every single person in our agency, project management, let alone creative and strategy, has to know what every platform is doing every day. The second we believe that a green screen piece of content has a higher likelihood, whether it's the, you know, I love when everyone's like, Gary, this platform shadow banned me. I'm not getting views. I'm like, nobody fucking shadow banned you. You just suck at making content. I'm not worried about the algorithm. I'm very aware after 20 years that the algorithm is make good shit and good shit will happen. Right now, that being said, every time you announce a new feature or your competitors announce a new feature, you naturally are trying to figure out if it's a good feature. So it's naturally good for creative people to try to use it as much as possible because you're probably gonna get a short-term extra organic reach because it's in the vested interest of the platform to understand if it's a good feature. So we have literally hundreds and hundreds of people every day obsessed about every single thing every platform is doing at the moment, and then an entire different group, yet one and the same sometimes if they have enough talent, that's paying attention to culture. Which rappers, which athletes, which soda, which fashion brand, which everything. What is happening in culture? And not just youth culture, what are moms in Indonesia care about? You know, what are people in Afghanistan consuming? Like literally global information on both platform and culture. And once that is your obsession and your ideas come from the framework of pack, your ideas will do better. You will get more quant and qual feedback from that. And that will create a collective wisdom of what you should be doing or what is touching the hearts and the minds. Because the only way someone does something, votes for someone, buys something, goes somewhere, is when that thing hit someone's relevance inside of them and led them to consider something. Marketing hasn't changed in a long time. The mediums and the creative strategies change. And the industry is holding on to yesterday for dear life. And I, and we've talked about it, am intrigued by tomorrow. I'm intrigued by tomorrow. This industry is obsessed with yesterday, but I and my companies, we fucking dominate today. Tomorrow's interesting and we'll keep an eye on it because it's coming. Yesterday is a nice romantic story, but it's the easiest waste of money of all time. It's today that we focus on, and I think that's what everybody should be focusing on.
Last one.
So why do you think 12 and a half? You have mentioned one story about one employee did a mistake with a bigger client, and you were about losing that bigger client.
Yes.
So my question is, you give that employee.
Yes.
What happened after everything suffered?
The question is based on a story in my last book where a client that's currently a client of Vayner today was representing over 20% of our revenue at the time. We're a very small company. And two of our employees thought they were signed into their personal Twitter account, but they were signed into the client's account. And they tweeted something negative about a different agency that we were working with. So literally, a Fortune 500 CPG brand tweets out something negative about one of their agency partners that was written by us. That was bad. We were a little bit more loose back then and didn't have our checks and balances in place. The head of that company reached out. It was a big to-do. It was very, very bad. And called me into a Midtown New York City hotel bar to have a meeting. I come to the meeting and it was a 5-minute meeting. She sat me down and said, unless you fire the two employees that did this, we will fire you. So in my brain, I'm like, if this client fires us, we are actually underwater. We are actually, our expenses will outweigh our actual like intake of dollars. And it took me all of a hundredth of a second to say to her, I understand, I really do, it makes sense, I understand the request, but unfortunately, you can decide to work with us, but you can't tell me who I fire and hire. This was a mistake. You also have the context of what pushed these employees to even do that in the first place, and I can't do that. She's like, okay, we'll speak tomorrow. Luckily for us, they didn't fire us. Super lucky now that they've become literally our largest client of revenue, but more lucky. And back to a lot of what we talked about here today, it is the single story that was the first brick of building the internal culture that is the currency of our organization. The utter shock in my organization that we didn't fire those two people was profound for a million reasons. Not only was it like, yeah, we fought against the client, it was that both of those employees weren't that great. I knew at the time that I was building this company forever. And I knew that I'd saved enough money in my personal bank account that I could loan the business money to get us through a year. And I knew that if I got punched in the face the next day and we got fired, that my pants would be on fire and I'd find more revenue. I also knew that there was never gonna be an opportunity, maybe quite like this, for me to show the company that I had their back at all versions, at all costs. And so I took that risk, but I it wasn't a risk. It was in my heart and in my brain. They both. Because as all of you know, a lot of things don't match up that way. A lot of us have something in our head, but not in our heart. Something in our heart, not in our head. If I can leave anything of positive impact on this talk today, anytime you have your heart and your brain 100% aligned on something, please stop hesitating. Because the only thing that's stopping you is your insecurity at that point. And it is your insecurity, your anxiety and insecurity in your body is always wrong. It's never right. And yet, a lot of you allow it to make decisions above your heart and your head. And it is the great mistake of the human being. So if you leave with anything, we talked about a lot of stuff today, but if you leave with anything, when your heart and your head agree, it's always right.
Thank you so much for listening to that episode. We want to remind you to drop your feedback in any way you can, whether that's dropping your comments in the Spotify comment section down below, tweeting Gary at Gary V, or dropping us a review on Apple Reviews. We really appreciate your feedback, and we'll see you in the next one.